All right, many of us will decide to go out for a ramble on a Sunday afternoon to walk off the dinner. Many people do that on St. Stephen's Day, particularly to walk off the Christmas dinner. Few people will spend Saturday afternoons trekking around the local mountains, be it in Wicklow or in Kerry. But how many of us would attempt to circumambulate the entire country? Well, that's exactly what the man sitting opposite me now has done. Peter Lynch, who's Met Air and Professor of Meteorology at University College Dublin, has just published a new book entitled Rambling Around Ireland, A Commodious Vicus of Recirculation. And in it, he tells us about the ups and downs, both literal and figurative, of walking all around our beautiful country. Peter, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Pat. Thank
what you. On earth made you undertake such a thing?
Fun.
Fun.
It's a wonderful country. It's a really nice place. You know better than I how saturated we are with bad news these days. And it's easy to blame the media, but really I think we have a taste for it too. I have a taste for good news. And this is a nice story about a wonderful country. It's a safe country. The people are really nice. They're great fun. As I say, the few exceptions are just a source of innocent merriment.
It was a spider in a bathtub that inspired you.
Well, it was a number of things. I mentioned the spider, and having removed him from the bath, I joked that I had a sense of omnipotence. But really, the idea had been tossing around in my head for some time, but I never really planned anything very carefully. Then I just took off one Sunday morning in the middle of December and did the first day and just went on from there.
Can you remember now, as a meteorologist, how the weather was in December 96?
It was a beautiful, cold, crisp morning. A cold front had just gone through. Visibility was good, clear skies. Very pleasant, cold and crisp.
Now, were you one of these mountainy men with the proper hiking boots and the walking stick and the thermal underwear and the over jackets and the woolly hat?
Not really. I had done a little hiking when I was in the Scouts long ago. That's really where the interest began. But not a lot in the meantime. I wasn't prepared. I didn't have boots. I had no stick. I just went off and learnt along the way.
Did you have any time scale in mind for this journey around the island?
Absolutely not. I thought maybe, well, I didn't think at all, but I suppose I would have guessed maybe 3 or 4 years. But it ended up taking 13 years. But I wasn't in a hurry. I mean, part of the fun is to take your time and look at things and talk to people.
And that you did. 13 years it took you. Did you do the full circuit?
Yeah, well, if you take all the stages and join them up, you get a continuous route around the country.
Because that was the idea, that you had to be able to join the dots.
Exactly. But of course, I did some stages out of order and some in reverse. I didn't want to be too fanatical. And there were a couple of ferry trips that we keep quiet about.
Now, were you alone most of the time or did you have company?
More than often, I had my buddies with me. It's much more fun, of course, if you're company and you're joking and laughing all the time.
You call them hill pigs. Why?
Well, that was a joke about a stick, a Burmese trekking stick invented by a character called Sir Geoffrey Hillpig Smythe, who was an inimitable character. And my wife bought us a couple of these sticks for walking.
Yeah, what are they like, the hill pigs?
Well, they're like a T, like a large, an elongated tall cross.
Yeah, and are they solid or do they compress? Do they vanish into themselves, those kind of sticks?
The hype that came with the sticks was a bit overblown. They were joined at the middle and tended to break after a little while. So we actually went on to ski poles afterwards, much better.
Now, where did you actually begin your journey?
Well, from my house, actually, but technically I took the Joyce's Tower in Sandy Cove to be the, as I say, the alpha and the omega of the Commodious Vicus. I mean, Joyce's Tower was the opening scene for Ulysses, possibly the greatest journey, one of the greatest journeys in literature.
So I thought that was a day. Yours was 13 years.
Well, that's right, yeah, but it takes people 13 years to read
it. It took Joyce as long, didn't it, to write it anyway?
At least, yeah.
That's for sure. All the royalties of the book are going to Scouting in Ireland. So you mentioned already your membership of the Scouting organisation. What is it about Scouting that still engenders that affection?
Well, I haven't had any direct association with them for 40 or 50 years. It's just happy memories. I remember as a kid having great fun lighting fires with sticks, and playing with knives and things you mightn't do. So we had a song actually in Dalkey. We are the 17th St. Begnet's Troop of Dorky. We often go on hikes, for we're very fond of walking. So I think I was brainwashed from an early age, in a good way.
Now, part of the book, of course, are the stories that emerge from it. And you got lots of local stories from local people. At the town of Ladysbridge in Cork, what's the story attached to
that?
Oh,
gosh, let me remember. Oh, well, we met a few inimitable characters in a pub. We were asking them about it. The Irish form is Drigheadh na Scuab, the Bridge of the Brushes. And we asked the locals, you know, what's this about? Oh, they knocked the black and tans off the bridge with brushes. So I said, well, how is it in English, ladies' bridge? Well, sure, 'twas the women was holding the brushes.
And what did you research that and find out? Was it true? Did the women have a go at the black and tans with the black and tans with their sweeping brushes?
I'd never spend too much time researching anything a Cork man told me.
There's a good Samaritan shopkeeper in Clonmel who managed to worry your family. That was in 1998. You were with Mark Draper, and you took a week to walk from Clonmel to Ballinacurra.
Well, it was a time before mobile phones were very popular, and we had one, I think, but probably switched off. So that's not very functional.
Yeah, in those days, they probably didn't have the kind of technology that could locate you so precisely as mobile phones can today.
Yeah, well, that's a double-edged sword, of course. It's nice to be lost in a little sense.
Mm. The most memorable adventures for you in all the 13 years, what would you say they were?
I think, some of the most beautiful places. I loved walking down the Barrow, the navigation of the Barrow down to New Ross. That was wonderful. Climbing the Devil's Mother, as it's politely called, was another. And really many things I remember. The Antrim Coast is about as good as it gets for walkers. It's a beautiful place. Yeah. I'd love to see a walking trail the whole way around the country. I think it's feasible. It wouldn't cost much. Wonderful attraction for tourists. Mm-hmm. And it could be a braid rather than a single track with multifarious circuits. Because one of the amazing things is you're constantly faced with choices. I call it Frost's Dilemma, where you see two beautiful roads and you've got to make a choice. So each person needs to solve Frost's Dilemma in his own way.
And there are, of course, places where there are obstacles put in your way. I'm thinking even close to Dublin, in Dublin, Spencer Dock.
Yeah, that's right. We ran into a bit of bother. We had to hop over a wall. The canal side track just expires at the North Strand, and it was a shame to leave the canal at that stage. So we flexed the law slightly and hopped over a wall, trying to make our way along the canal. But we were met by a gentleman who was not too pleased to see us, a security man, who, asked us, how did we get in? And I said, I didn't answer the question. I said, we came in by mistake. We're trying to get out. And he rang his supervisor. "Tis come in by mistake and is trying to get out." He was an Algerian guy. And I felt when he said that he was on our side.
So he let you out.
He actually let us out exactly where we hoped to go.
Now, you are currently, as I mentioned at the beginning, Met Aaron Professor of Meteorology at UCD. Mathematics, I remember when I was in college years ago that the people who went for meteorology were... they had to be mathematical geniuses. Is that still the case? Is it highly mathematically modelled, or is it more about satellites and seeing what's already out there and working out what's going to happen next?
No, the reason we can forecast the weather now for 4 or 5 days ahead is due to the computer models. And they're based on the physical laws, which are mathematically expressed and written as computer programs. I mean, there's been fantastic progress in the last 20 or 30 years. And really, it has become a very technical and mathematical subject.
And what about the role of the weather stations, which tell you what's reasonably local to us, and then the satellites, which tell you what's going on, as we've seen over the last few days, whether it's over the Arctic or over the Atlantic?
Yeah, they're actually vital components as well. I mean, all science begins with data. You've got to observe the atmosphere today before you can talk about tomorrow's weather. And then the computer crunches out the predictions. And then there's a big job for the forecaster, who has to be an excellent communicator.
And how much of it is intuitive on the part of the forecaster, who says, yeah, I've seen this before, I know what the mathematical model is telling me, but I have a feeling that there's going to be a thaw, not on Wednesday night, but perhaps on Tuesday night.
Yeah, I think they build up a bank of skill. They have ability to modify the forecast. It would be a very courageous forecaster who'd completely ignore the computer predictions, but they can modify them, and they do so, and particularly in the very short range where they can see new things happening on the radar and satellites. So they have a lot to add to the computer forecast.
You know, every single year on this station and on other stations, you get people, local people coming on who've watched the dolphins, for example, or the feeding habits of the birds. And, you know, science would tend to ignore those things. But yet when the tsunami was coming, the elephants were able to tune into the rumble and made for high ground. Now, do scientists like yourselves ever look at those, if you like, peripheral signs that are not part of the mathematical modelling, not part of climate science, but can tell you something, maybe, about what might lie ahead?
Yeah, this is not my area, seismology, but I imagine if the elephants can sense something, then very sensitive seismographs can sense it too. You know, it's a matter of learning, are there precursors for these extreme events.
Yeah, but looking at the birds, you know, devouring certain kinds of berries instead of their usual food because they know lean times lie ahead.
Yeah, I don't buy that. I think that it's more a question of what's happened already. I mean, I saw some signs of change. We spotted a little egret down in Youghal. Now, 20, 30 years ago, we wouldn't have seen these birds. Now they're all over Ireland. So these are changes, maybe, maybe not associated with climate change. It's very hard to say. But changes have always gone on like that.
Now, you were instrumental in setting up the UCD Meteorology and Climate Change, or Climate Centre, I won't say change, although that's almost inevitable in climate. It's changing all the time. That was in 2004. What do you do?
Well, I'm professor of meteorology, so we have undergraduate and postgraduate courses. So I lecture to students. We carry out research in a whole range of areas. One of my particular interests is in the numerical schemes used to solve the equations for making these weather forecasts.
Yeah. I had imagined, I remember, as I say, years ago when people were going to study this, that they had to be mathematical geniuses. You always imagine that somehow the computers will do all that sort of crunching for you these days.
No, I mean, the computers do what they're told. We have to draw up the programs. I mean, we don't have to be geniuses. Let's be balanced. They just have to be people who are talented at mathematics.
Now, going back to your book, Rambling Round Ireland, A Commodious Vicus of Recirculation, which, by the way, is published by the Liffey Press. Learning from what you've done and experienced, what would you say to people who want to emulate you in some way, part or all of your journey?
Yeah, first of all, I'd say anyone can walk around Ireland. It was no heroic act. I mean, I slept in a bed every night. I got a few blisters and a few drenchings, but nothing, no real hardship. So I'd encourage anyone to think about it. Planning is great fun, so I'd say to them, you know, plan your route. My route is given in the book in detail, but I wouldn't encourage people to follow it. Much more fun to pick your own route. Solve Frost's dilemma in your own way.
Yeah. Anyway, good walking boots, good gear. GPS is probably a useful thing to have. And maps. It's amazing how many people go out and they're depending on signposts to get them around the place.
Well, don't do that. I did have one experience that I tell in the book where I spent the entire day walking in a grand cyclonic gyre and ended up back where I started. Overcast, no map, no compass. Very silly.
Yeah, could have ended up in tragedy if you're in the wrong place. You know,
well,
if you're somewhere up in the Wicklow Mountains and the fog comes down, the freezing fog, who knows?
So. Yeah, I deliberately avoided taking risks. That was quite a mild day, if very wet. Yeah. But yes, indeed, there is danger if you're up on high ground.
Well, as I say, Rambling Round Ireland, A Commodious Vicus of Recirculation by Peter Lynch is published by the Liffey Press. And Peter, thank you very much for joining us in studio this morning.
Thank you, Pat.